Like I said earlier, this has been a relatively busy weekend for me, so I haven't had much opportunity to dig into a lot of comics, but I am still going to do Last Comic Standing this week, because I didn't do any last week, so we actually have a fair bit to cover. Let's see, what do we have here? Our first selection on the list here from last week is FF2 by Jonathan Hickman and Steve Epting. This is the reboot of Fantastic Four. The FF actually stands for Future Foundation, this futuristic think tank led by Reed Richards, who has been now funding the Fantastic Four. But this is very much a return to form of your classic Fantastic Four formula, your crazy super science, your little bit of family drama thrown in there. But this is dealing still with the death of the Human Torch in the last issue of the old Fantastic Four series, also written by Jonathan Hickman. Now, in order to replace the Human Torch, the team has brought on Spider-Man, who is a family friend of the entire family. At the same time, though, there's sort of friction, because Reed Richards' daughter Valerie has recommended, for unknown as of yet to us reasons, to bring in Dr. Doom onto the team. So this issue follows Reed Richards' attempt to convert Dr. Doom to the side of good through this giant machine that's going to scramble his brain. Now, this plot has been done to death before, the bad guy turning good, but will he stay good or will he become a double agent? And I'm not so sure this is the most inventive plot I've ever seen from Jonathan Hickman. Jonathan Hickman can get really crazy and unbounded when he wants to, and that's a great thing. It's very much in the vein of classic, like, 60s Ray Bradbury, and he can just throw in as many crazy sci-fi concepts as he wants into his stewpot, and still make a very human and engaging and emotional story. I can't say I found that here. Also of issue is this version of Spider-Man, who I don't think Hickman really has as much of a grasp on Spider-Man as current contemporary writers do, like Dan Slott and even Tom DeFalco. Maybe I'm just being spoiled in that Dan Slott has been working miracles in these last 10 or 15 issues that he's done of Amazing Spider-Man, but I don't really think, if you're going to do something as drastic as killing a major character and then introducing Spider-Man in their place, you better have decent places to take the new direction, and I'm not quite positive that I'm seeing that yet from FF. But I will stick with it for another couple issues, and we'll see if it stays on my pull list. Also from last week was the much better Scalped 48 from Jason Aaron and R.M. Gura. This issue of Scalped, we've got two issues until the landmark double-sized Scalped number 50, and geez is the pressure mounting. If I had to describe this issue in one sentence, it would be the last temptation of Dashiell Badhorse. We see the three forces that are working in Dashiell's life right now, namely the FBI through Agent Nitz, his relationship with Red Crow, and trying to alleviate the grief of the death of his mother, and at the same time, his attempts to see himself as a man of faith through this mysterious Catcher character that's been showing up as of late, who we found out a couple issues ago was actually the one that killed Dashiell's mother. If you haven't read Scalped, it is very likely that none of that just made sense to you. But that is a testament to how layered Jason Aaron's writing can get at some points. Every issue of Scalped has led in to the next, even when it appears fairly standalone and fairly self-contained. The plot lines in this series bleed in on each other, and work on top of each other in new and interesting ways so that you really become invested in these characters. Couple things I found of note here. RM Gura is on fire in this issue. He has some great workings of this whole spider web aesthetic going on as the triple life, so to speak, of Dashiell becomes further entangled and things become more disjointed. There's this great scene with him and Lincoln Redcrow in a sweat lodge where some very scary eye-popping things end up being hallucinated by Dash. Also of note is the great characterization of Lincoln Redcrow in this issue, who really does seem to have turned over a new leaf here. Like I said in my initial recommendation of Scalped, it is impossible to box this character into your typical hero or villain role. And, like I said, it's a great benefit of Jason Aaron's that he can make this guy seem honest and sincere on one page while having him seem brutal and cold on the next. I really like the dichotomy of faith versus realism that's going on through Catcher, and ever since he came back into the forefront a couple issues ago with Officer Falls Down, he's really kind of revolutionized the book and gave it yet another spark of energy. I'm not to say that Scalp has been spinning its wheels, because it certainly hasn't, but Catcher and the dynamic between him, Red Crow, Bad Horse, and Gina has really kicked the book into full gear as we head toward a major climax in the story in 2 months in Scalp's issue 50. We also had Sweet Tooth number 21 this week, written and drawn, as always, by Jeff Lemire. Now, I feel like Sweet Tooth, I just now caught up with it a couple days ago, right up until this issue, and I feel like it's sort of been spinning its wheels a bit. In contrast to Scalped, it never seems to give you enough to want to turn that next page. And when it does, that is spread out over many, many issues. I like when we finally get the mysteries to these sorts of things revealed, like what caused these children to be born as half-animal and half-human creatures. But at the same time, I feel like the story is currently suffering some pacing problems that doesn't make the story as enthralling as it could be. That said, Sweet Tooth 21 was a okay issue. A new character was introduced, whose name escapes me, but he is the last survivor of a group of scientists calling themselves Project Evergreen, who have taken refuge in this dam in order to find out the root cause of the plague. So he's pretty much on this island of food and water and shelter, trying to survive out the plague, the last one there. It had a very Walking Dead vibe to it, this issue, which I think was a very good thing. Also, there was a great, beautifully illustrated fight between Jeopard and a grizzly bear as he tries to reconcile his relationship with Gus after the killing of Buddy. Those parts of the issue more than made up for the bit of a drag going on back at Project Evergreen, because they were sort of bringing some tears to my eyes. So I give that issue of Sweet Tooth probably a solid middle-of-the-road score. We also, from last week, had American Vampire number 14, written by Scott Snyder and drawn by Raphael Albuquerque. Now, at this point, you should know that anytime I say written by Scott Snyder, that is code word for this comic is awesome. Because Scott Snyder refuses to stay in one comfortable niche for American Vampire. For the last couple issues, we've had a noir, more pulpish detective tale. for the first couple issues, we had a Western, and now we have a very much Saving Private Ryan war-type movie, as the characters of American Vampire pick up a gun and go to serve the country in the wake of World War II. I don't feel like I can say much about the storyline until it concludes in a couple issues, but I will say I'm enjoying it very much, very gritty, very dark, and I don't think that everyone is going to make it out alive. Also, J.H. Williams III better watch out, because Raphael Albuquerque is quickly becoming one of the best artists in comics today. Next, we've got Secret 633 by Gail Simone and Jay Calafiore. Now, I should not have to tell you that every issue of Secret 6 is knocked down, drag out, great comics. But this one is especially so because it is the conclusion to a story arc in which six of the most demented criminals on the face of the planet, actually eight of them, I believe, end up in their eternal resting place in H.E. Double Hockey Sticks. And this is every bit as gut-punching, every bit as torturous, and even somewhat heartwarming as you'd expect a storyline like this to be. It's clear by this point that this storyline is going to have major implications for all of our characters. When you learn that all of your team, all of the people who you value and love so much, are going to end up being eternally punished, that's going to leave an impact on you. Also concluded in here is Catman's quest for revenge on his abusive father, and the results of that quest must be seen to be believed. It involves plenty of face-eating. Anyway, Secret 633, great conclusion to the storyline. A lot of interesting stuff with Scandal's girlfriend, Liana, and the ethics of herself and her chosen career profession. So many times, with characters like these who aren't involved with the most currently legal of things, you have them portrayed as either brainless or immoral. Liana is neither, and that is going to make it all the more gut-punching if we end up losing the character in this storyline. What amazes me, day in and day out about Secret Six, just when you think you know everything about a character, just when you think you could sit down and tell anyone about them, just when you think you could sit down and write their autobiography, there's a new wrinkle to them, a new complexity that you didn't see coming that makes you simultaneously disgust them and want to just give them a big hug. Next month begins a two-part story arc on Bane, but I really hope they use some of the time in those issues to conclude this fantastic storyline, because at the end of this issue, spoiler alert, Scandal is faced with the choice of bringing her dead girlfriend, Knockout, back from eternal punishment, or keeping her current living girlfriend alive. She can't choose both, however, meaning that one of them is going to have to die. Next, we have something that I actually touched upon briefly last week, but still wanted to get to today. It's Action Comics 900 by Paul Cornell, Pete Woods, and a crap ton of other amazing artists and writers. The main story in here, I have to be honest, is a little bit lackluster and not worth a $5 price tag of an 80-odd page issue like this one. At the same time, however, it's the backup stories where this issue really shines. Let's talk about the main story first, though. I have made it no small secret, if you follow me on Twitter, that I am really digging Paul Cornell's run on Action Comics, in which he shines the spotlight not on Superman, but on the depraved, tortured, horrible genius of Lex Luthor. And until now, Superman's name has barely even been mentioned. 10 issues later, however, in Action Comics 900, after Luthor has gained almost godlike powers from the influence of an alien artifact called the Black Ring, Superman's ready to come back into the fray, and the results aren't pretty. Well, actually, that's a lie, because this book is drawn by Pete Woods, and the results are very, very pretty. This is one of the best cosmic, otherworldly battles that I've seen in comics in quite a while, very reminiscent of the confrontation between Frau Totenkinder and the Dark One, if you've ever read Fables. But this was pretty much an entire issue of fight scenes. But even then, Paul Cornell's excellent, snappy dialogue managed to not only keep the pace flowing, but proves that he can write Superman every bit as well as he can write Superman's adversaries. Before now, I was relatively skeptical of whether I was happy about Paul Cornell and Pete Woods continuing in Action Comics post the Black Ring. That being said, this issue has boosted my confidence. For the next 4, 5, 6 issues, this comic will be involved in the Reign of Doomsday crossover, and a huge part of the book's real estate was devoted to that. To be quite frank, it kind of sucks. But I have no doubt that once Paul Cornell and Pete Woods are able to free themselves from that editorial mandate, some great things will be happening on Superman, so keep your eyes peeled to Action Comics. The backup stories in this issue, though, as I said, are where you really get some fantastic stuff. Most of these things rely on the last-minute twist, so to even talk about them in much detail would pretty much ruin them. You have an excellent story about Paul Dini, or not about Paul Dini, by Paul Dini, that shows Superman addressing an alien, about why he does the things that he does, very reminiscent of a lot of Eastern religions, actually. You've got a story by Richard Donner, who wrote many of the Superman movies. That's just your very classic Superman tale with a little bit of modern spice thrown in that really makes it kind of pop off the page. You've got the aforementioned David S. Goyer story that we talked about last week, wherein Superman renounces his U.S. citizenship, that personally had a huge impact on me. Whenever superheroes address current events and it doesn't suck, that is a gift among men. And also, you've got only 8 pages of story by Damon Lindelof that I am not ashamed to admit, through the power of the last page twist that he popularized so much on Lost, reduced me to a blubbering pile of flesh by the end. For anyone that says they know everything there is to know about Superman's origin and that you can't teach an old dog new tricks, read this story and your mind will explode into little flesh pieces all over your skull. That about does it for this week's Last Comic Standing and for this week's Sugared Tomatoes. If you have any thoughts about Osama bin Laden or about political scapegoats or about the comics I talked about today, you can leave them in the comments down below. You can contact R.W. Mead on Twitter by using @RWMead, myself on Twitter by using @TomatoSurprise, Sugared Tomatoes on Twitter by using @SugaredTomatoes, or you can email us with longer form inquiries through our email address, which is sugaredtomatoes@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Oh, and R.W. Mead, I will have to remind you that you still have to do your non-cat punishment at some point.